Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Let's get this session underway. So we're very fortunate to have the CEOs of two of our large and successful life insurance companies. And I think it's terrific that Brett and Damien have actually not just made the time but have showed willingness to come here and talk about some challenging times for the industry. And they both expressed a willingness to be very frank and to address issues that really are quite confronting, I think, in many ways. So I want to thank them for that. In return, though, please respect the fact that they've actually been willing to do this. And if you're going to talk about this session, do so in the spirit in which these guys have participated. Okay. We're going to have a Q&A session. So initially, I'll ask Damien and Brett a series of questions, and then we'll pick up questions from the audience as they arrive. Let me introduce the two speakers. So Brett Clark is the Group Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director of TAL. He's been there since April 15. He joined TAL in August 08 as CEO of their retail operations. And in May 13, he was appointed CEO of TAL Life with responsibility for retail life, group life, investments and financial advice businesses. He is a qualified actuary and he's worked in a range of senior executive roles over many years, gaining a deep industry experience across a broad range of functions, including strategy, finance, sales, product and marketing and operations in both the Australian and international insurance market. So he brings a considered and commercial approach to insurance markets and leadership across TAL's diversified life insurance business. He's a member of the FSE Board of Directors and he's an executive officer of Daiichi Life Holdings. Damien Mu has more than 18 years' experience in the financial services industry in Australia, with management experience spanning operations, claims, underwriting, superannuation investments, distribution, product pricing and marketing.
Jeez.
Damien's career at AIA began in April 07, and over that time he's held various roles as head of group insurance, chief distribution and marketing officer, and the role of general manager of life insurance. And in this time, the company achieved significant positive growth across all three channels of the business and was the recipient of a number of major life insurance awards. And in August 14, he was appointed to the role of CEO, a reflection of his instrumental part in driving AIA Australia's growth and sustained success. And in July 16, AIA New Zealand was added to his responsibilities. So you can see both of them have really deep and valid experience, and I'm really quite looking forward to the conversation.
Sounds like a competition for the longest bio.
There's been some long ones.
I'm going to have to work on mine.
Yes. I was going to say, obviously, we have got a lot of people in our marketing department. But, I should just declare, though, before we get into it, and Brett, I'm not actually a qualified actuary. You would have heard that in there. But I did get my honorary actuary diploma from Brett himself. So I feel very privileged to be here next week.
I did hand that over to Damien many, many years ago now. Sure. It was missing from the bio.
It was.
I think you did.
I didn't think it was appropriate. But now that I know there's no media, it's okay.
Bush actuary,
Gentlemen... Gentlemen, as you know, there's been a whole range of topics and issues canvassed over the last 2 days concerning life insurance. And I thought it would be worthwhile if we started at a really quite high level and then we'll consider some of the more detailed points. So there's been talk about social licence and the life industry's role in society and so on. And yesterday we had a conversation about the state of the social licence for the life insurance industry and what sort of state it's actually in. And so let's start with, at a very high level, your views on how, in what sort of state our social licence is in, how well we're meeting the expectations and so on of the community. So, Brett, let's start with you.
Well, it's a fairly obvious thing to say. I think that we've got a fair amount of work to do. These questions of social licence also go to this broader perspective of sustainability, and that's been a question asked about the life insurance industry on and off now for quite a few years. And when you ask yourself those questions about sustainability from whose perspective? When we had the group insurance meltdown back in 2013, there were lots of questions about sustainability. That was largely asking questions about us. And I think we've moved on quite a way since that time, where we need to understand that sustainability for the life insurance industry means sustainability and social licence from perspective a whole range of different stakeholders. It's not just a conversation about us and how healthy our balance sheet is. It's a conversation about, are we delivering to our customers, community expectations, regulatory expectations, government, and then ultimately media as well. The things that I've learnt very quickly over the last 2 years is that you talk about all these different stakeholders in your world, but they are all very well connected also, and how those connections work with each other you need to be very mindful of when thinking about these ideas of social licence and sustainability.
Okay, well, we'll come back to sustainability in a minute. Damien?
Yeah, and I think it's really a relevant question, isn't it, social licence? I think when we look at where we found ourselves, and let's start with the life insurance industry, if you say the media would say we haven't done a good job and we haven't fulfilled our obligations from a social licence perspective, I think we haven't done a great job in actually talking to the market and talking to the rest of the world about what we do to make a difference in people's lives. And I think we haven't been able to have that narrative well developed or well spoken about. But so when you look at just what the media talks about, you'd say we haven't fulfilled our obligations under our social licence. But I go step back a second and I actually think about it more broadly in terms of financial services and you know, really right now we've been found wanting in regards to how we've delivered on our social licence and whether or not we've actually taken that seriously. And I think unintentionally somewhere along the line we've confused, you know, CSR and projects that we, you know, fund over here around charitable organisations and others has been the same as social licence, and that's not what it is at all. We need to continue to do that, but what actually social licence is about the privilege that you have as an organisation to operate within an ecosystem where what you do within society contributes to society. And economic returns and share price is just not enough. So what we need to find is how do we get that focus back on the social aspect of our licence, and what do we need to do to be able to demonstrate that we're worthy of that licence. And I think life insurance is a great place to start, because actually what we do contributes to make a difference to society. We help Australians and their families when they need it most. That doesn't mean we don't need to continue to improve the system and shine a light on the areas that don't work as optimally as they should, but actually it's a great place to start. So we need to actually get back around our shared value narrative, and I know you're going to jump into sustainability, so I'll leave my comments for that, but we've got to start that journey and reclaim our licence there.
And do you think we have expressed our social purpose very well? Or do you think it's even clear in the industry itself?
Not at all. I think purpose is gone. Purpose is a great word, and you know, let's not talk. I talk about purpose as being it's not 9 to 5, and the defining factor around purpose is you actually have to care. So you'll be tested if you don't have a genuine purpose. But I think we've lost our purpose. You know, I don't want to get too philosophical, but when I sit back, I get despondent and disappointed that, you know, we do so much good, yet we've lost our way. And how do we find our way back when it comes to community expectations and customers' expectations? And for me, I think purpose is where it starts. And as a society, you know, as a first generation migrant Australian, I feel very blessed and privileged to have been born in this country. And, you know, the dream was to have your own home. And, you know, I think now we've sort of evolved to that's been so important, but it's about your next home and the better home and the better home. And as a society, we've got to get back to our core purpose, which is how do we help Australians achieve a happier, healthier life given the blessings we have in this wonderful nation. So purpose is very important at a societal level, and then within organisations we need to find our purpose, and our purpose must be around, you know, how we make a difference to society while also contributing to shareholder and returns and delivering on the capital promise.
Right. In an industry like life insurance, purpose is very important, but I also think it's very straightforward as well. We provide protection for millions of Australians. A large number of those will go through some very difficult times in their lives, and our purpose is to make sure we pay the claim and look after them to the best of our ability when those times happen. Damien's touched on whether, you know, we've lost our way or not. I suppose the question for me is, have we always been very crisp around that as our purpose and as our identity as a sector? And I think
as a role in society.
Yeah, and I think we've been reminded of that, very clearly in the last few years.
So how well do you think we as an industry understand social norms and expectations and how they're changing and how fast they're changing and so on?
I think we do our best. My observation would be that social norms, expectations and community standards are moving very, very fast, and they're moving fast for all the sorts of reasons that we know about in terms of technology, social media and all those things that get talked about a lot at events like this. I think the challenge we've got as companies and industry is being able to keep pace, in that those expectations continue to move very, very quickly and get shaped by things like raw commissions and other things. And as an industry, are we able to keep pace quickly enough and move our businesses and cultures quickly enough to keep pace? And that's tough. That's difficult in financial services, and it's difficult in life insurance businesses. We may get to it today or not, but it's something APRA have talked about around legacy and those sorts of things, and how quickly we're able to move our businesses forward to deal with those rapidly changing expectations.
And selling long-term insurance contracts in a market where people are looking increasingly short-term, do you think that's an issue?
Yeah, I think it is. I think there's a very big question here about how life insurance as an idea evolves. And I was looking at the board out there around the federal government budget changes, and there were the red, amber, green stickers in there. And I think one of the green ones said, get rid of the cross subsidies or something like that. Life insurance is the biggest cross subsidy in town. Mm. The people that don't claim pay for the people that do. It's all about cross subsidies, people. So, you know, you've got to understand that fundamentally about life insurance. It is the biggest cross subsidy in town. That's the whole idea of risk pooling. And this goes directly to the heart of, I think, your question, Ian, is society is moving very, very rapidly about what it means for people to be part of a community, the willingness of someone to be part of a pool, to say, I'm a healthy life, am I prepared to pay a premium or make a contribution for someone who's less healthy, and how do I feel about that? That same discussion's happening in health insurance.
Yeah. And Damien, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think absolutely. So I think we've been very good at understanding and developing financial economic models to help us with, you know, how we set about developing products and pricing. But increasingly, I think what we've recognised is, when we look back, what's been missing is the behavioural economic factors, and how do we actually get good at that? Because that's what's going to help us to look forward, because the financial economic models pretty much look back and then sort of try and come up with an economic financial trend, but they don't factor in the X and the Y around behavioural economics and what behaviours are changing. A good example is, you know, assuming that the apathy of people within superannuation around their insurance would continue to exist forever. And then what happened? We all got very good at marketing around insurance, and then people started opting in, and it got away from us because we didn't have the behavioural economics impact. I think when we think about the challenge for people sitting in this room today, it's a tough challenge, right? Firstly, when we talk about life insurance, I think, you know, if you were to look at group insurance and say 80 cents in the dollar gets paid back out, I think the people in this room and the broader community have done a good job. Right? There's not many industries or sectors you could say has actually done a really good job over that time to get that bit right, where there's good value for the customer over a sustained period, and to be able to price that. But we can get better at behavioural economics. I think the challenge, Ian, really quickly, is, you know, each generation sort of goes, feels like it's had the most challenging time and the most difficult problems to solve, you know, and then you sort of forget that there were wars and there were famines. But I think the challenge for us, that's not to underplay our challenge, I think Brett's hit it on the head as well. I talk about it as being one of assimilation. The rate of change and pace of change around, whether it's because of technology or life or expectations or connectedness or, you know, whatever, means that we don't have time to assimilate very quickly. No sooner than we do something else has already changed. So you might have had these big events in the past, but then society has time to assimilate from that. We're finding we're going from not big events, but little events that have impact constantly. So we don't have time as a society or as an industry to assimilate to that change. So you're sort of compounding as you go. So that's the challenge. How do we factor in and understand those social norms through data and relationships with people and customers, and engaging in a dialogue to be able to factor in those behavioural economic models into the financial ones?
And that's a nice lead in to sustainability, I think. So earlier this afternoon there was a session on disability income insurance and the challenge that it poses for the industry, and the fact that, you know, it's posed challenges for a long period of time. So we might use disability income as to illustrate the point, but perhaps from each of you, how would you define sustainability for the industry? What does sustainability actually look like? So, Brett?
I think it's got to... You've got to have a wider reference for sustainability across a range of different stakeholders. I think too often, I'm sort of going back to what I said a little bit earlier, we've referenced sustainability about the health of our own balance sheet or the health of our own returns of our own business. That is only one component of what sustainability must mean for an organisation today. It has to be sustainable for the customers first. Is there a good value exchange in the products and services that you are providing? The customer groups, distributors, shareholders, regulators, broader society, and that plays into social licence for me also, Ian. So I think you have to look at sustainability through a multiple stakeholder lens.
Okay. And Damien, your view on sustainability?
So I agree with what Brett said about sustainability at a macro level. I think if we look more specifically at, I think you said disability income.
Disability insurance, yeah.
Insurance. Yeah. I think we see differing aspects across, depending on a couple of factors, the distribution method, the product complexity, and of course then looking at the claim services that goes with that. So I think when we look at IP, a disability, there has been pockets where clearly in the retail market now we're saying the price increases continue, so if they keep continuing then is it really sustainable, does that make sense? So I'm getting at a more micro level rather than macro and thinking about it in that context. I think what we're finding is that the answer is not just about removing benefits or overly generous benefits. It's also about understanding and getting better data and insights. So what do I mean by that? When we look at income protection in the retail sector, actually one of the highest causes of claims is around mental illness that comes as a secondary result. So what that means is if we can understand that the largest cause of mental health conditions in income protection, for example, when we did some studies in our book, was around those traditionally in the blue collar area, is we actually have a chance to avoid those claims or help prevent those claims. Not avoid, prevent those claims, sorry, I should say, because when they first come to us as an injury or illness, at that point in time, we can now tell from the data that there's a high likelihood that they're going to need more support services than just to pay a check to get through that injury or illness. They're going to need further help around assimilating to a new life or finding a job or other things, and then therefore preventing what becomes the unsustainable aspect, which is the second income protection claim around mental health and the largest cause for mental health claims as a result of the secondary. So I think data becomes very important, Ian, and we need to, as an industry, and you guys should know that more than anyone, right, is we need to really get better data and understand those insights so that we can then be better at getting the product settings right and the sustainability of our pricing so that we're not looking at increases year on year.
Okay, so let's stay with disability income for a minute. And it wasn't clear, really, from the conversation earlier today that there was any obvious solution to the profitability issue for disability income insurance. And so if you wanted to change one thing, if you wanted to see one thing different in the disability income market, what would that actually be?
I think the... When we talk about disability income protection, we usually reference retail long-term income protection, because there are other forms of it in group and other parts of the market, but principally I think it's around retail. I'm not very optimistic for retail income protection. And the reason I'm not very optimistic is that when I look out into the future, I don't see a lot of growth in retail per se and in retail income protection per se. So then you have a pool which over time, I think, naturally becomes, and this is the challenge I think for people in this room and outside of this room, the actuarial profession, is how do you deal with a pool of lives at an aggregate market level in income protection that becomes more anti-select over time?
Yes, that's right.
That is a big challenge. That's not easily solved by looking backwards into the data. You need to look forwards and form some judgments around these things. And we need to start soon as an industry to try and solve this, because the longer you leave it, the harder the problem is to solve. I think the only thing in my mind that can structurally address some of these challenges is product design, and in some respects maybe radical product design, because price will not solve it. Price will only lead you faster and further into a poor outcome, and we're seeing that today.
We do.
Prices go up, consumers go, is this a fair exchange of value? No, it's not. The healthy ones leave, unhealthy ones stay, and away you go, away you go, away you go, down the plug hole. So you need to address it quickly and sooner rather than later, and I think it has to absolutely be solved with product design, which creates a fair exchange of value between customer and advisor in this context and life insurer.
Yeah, so something to break it. So, yeah. Damien, you're...
Yeah, I don't think there's just one thing I'd ask for. I think it actually is looking at it, maybe I've extended it a little bit to the proposition, because I think it is about the product design, but also the service, the claims services that go with it. I mean, we know that, you know, through the work that we've all done in the life insurance industry around rehabilitation and return to work, that actually there's a really good success rate that can be achieved, and therefore that helps the sustainability of the product as well. But I think it's actually looking at the proposition overall. How is it constructed in terms of product design? How is it distributed? You know, where do rating agencies play a role in that to drive the wrong outcome? Because actually, you know, and then the regulatory environment. So it's all the overlays, because actually, how does an advisor, you know, today think about the challenge of being a financial advisor right now, when you've got to demonstrate all these obligations that you've fulfilled, you have to rely and outsource it, part of it, to something that, you know, compares selectors and does all that stuff for you. But that just drives you down a whole other path. So I don't think it's about just picking one part of the chain. I think we need an overhaul and interventions in all of those areas to look at how we get to a sustainable system.
And what would actually be the trigger to do that? It's easy for us to talk about this, what's actually going to make it happen?
I think Peter Kell might have spoken.
He did
this morning in a session here. I read a bit online on the Fin, and I think he was talking about some of these issues which exist in other areas as well. I mean, we've dealt with it in life insurance, in retail again, actually, in relation to commissions. Mm-hmm. And I think Peter was referencing around this whole first mover disadvantage, and you've actually got to break that cycle where you're playing a game of chicken with your competitors to try and work out, you know, how you go forward. And he was referencing good examples where industry has been able to come up with solutions which ultimately are good for customers, industry and life insurers, that sort of cartwheel of stakeholders. And I think when you think about those examples, commissions, life code and other things, then I think in a way that doesn't get you into hot water with ACCC and other things, thinking about that in terms of product and the broader proposition that Damien's thinking about as well, that there ultimately has to be at some point a come to Jesus moment here. We can't keep staying on the train tracks which are going to go over the edge of the cliff at some point. There has to be the realisation where we need to do something.
Okay, so Damien, there was a mention there of ratings houses, and they clearly play a very important role in terms of, on the one hand, inherent value, but also for helping advisors.
Yes.
But they also, and have done for many years, drive insurance companies to design products that score points.
Yeah.
So let's say, Brett, the industry takes up your broad suggestion to break the product, create a new one which is going to better meet the needs.
Still good for customers.
Yes. What if the ratings houses don't address that in a way that will encourage advisors to use the product?
So I think rating houses do play an important role because you have to be able to aggregate that information and distill it. But I think what we need to think about is how do we ensure that all parts of the chain have appropriate oversight and regulation? And what I mean by that is, you know, how do we ensure that the quality of what the rating houses is doing and there's consistency so that when you are comparing apples with apples and that we're not, you know, leaving it up to, individual organisations to determine what's best and not best. There should be some consistency and there should be a framework and a regulation of oversight over that as well, because that impacts just as much, as I said, when you go through the whole value chain, the end outcome for the customer.
So who should regulate that then?
Well, I haven't thought that one through yet, but I'll come up with that. But no, I don't mean I'm not looking at regulation for regulation. So I'm talking about oversight so that there is some consistency, because it does vary from, you know, different rating houses to different rating houses, and we want to make sure that it's all working towards, as you know, Brett and I've talked about earlier, overall a sustainable industry. But just jumping off, I think just wanted to answer one question though before I finish on the rating agencies, is that there will be a natural time, right? And whether it is, as Brett said, when the train goes over the cliff, but eventually customers will say the exchange is not fair anymore and I'm not paying that, so then no one will sell any more of it, and then organisations will have to do something about it. Or there will be, as we've seen in other parts and time in history, where the economic losses exceed the point where people say we're not putting our capital there.
So group insurance went over went over the cliff.
That's right.
But do you really want the industry, the disability income train, to go over the cliff?
No.
Absolutely not. From a customer point of view, whatever you might think about the product and its complexity and sophistication, in inverted commas, today, it absolutely meets a very important customer need. What's the two biggest assets that any individual will have? Is usually the house and their ability to earn an income.
Yep.
And to ensure those two things is vitally important for any individual or family's economic security. So it absolutely has to remain as a product which is viable, hence we need to address some of these issues.
So on balance, are rating houses good for customers, not advisors?
I think it depends over what time period you're talking about. If I can sort of answer it that way without trying to avoid it, the question is that rating houses, it's easy to put the crosshairs on them and have a crack. But they would argue that they have developed better consumer products over a period of time, better features, better understood for advisors. That may be true over the shorter term. Over the longer term, that ultimately ends up in claims and price somewhere. And so we're dealing with the outcome of some of those issues now. I think rating houses would acknowledge this also, that they need to take a broader perspective on how they rate companies and their products, and it's not just about who's got the cheapest price and who's got the most generous definitions, which has pretty much been the situation up until now, maybe changing a little bit. But, you know, there is much more to a life insurance company's proposition than price and definitions.
Should there be a better, more structured approach to relations between the industry and the rating houses at an industry level?
I think there's close relationships now. There's a lot of lobbying that goes on.
No, I wasn't thinking so much of lobbying.
Yeah.
More about good practice. You know, what's going to be good for the industry, the customers?
Maybe we need a code of practice for rating houses.
Maybe we do. Another code of practice.
We can't have enough.
Well, but Ian, the point is, you know, if you actually have to look at it as an end-to-end delivery and chain, right? Because if only certain parts of that chain are regulated or sign up to a code, then other parts creep in, and then you go, right, okay, at the end, the customer's there at the end, right? So how do we make sure we have that consistency and alignment along the way?
Yep. Okay. Let's move on to something.
I would just add, Ian, I think ultimately when you look at the challenges around that product, you can sort of point fingers all over the place and go, oh, it's the rating house's problem, or it's, reinsurers,
or it's distributors,
or it's that life insurer X who's, not charging the right price. Life insurance companies have these decisions in their hand. They can make them or not. Mm. And so I think ultimately that's where the responsibility lies to affect change.
Mm-hmm. What about simplified versions of products? Do you see a future where much simpler, easier to understand products sit alongside the more sophisticated versions? Damien?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should have choice and simplified products and definitely give the customer the choice of that, right? And we're seeing it coming through. I mean, you know, one of the things we've done is we knew that, you know, and there's some of the team from AA here, you have to step out and try to do it, but I don't think it's, you know, one of the ways we said was actually we're going to come out with some new products. It's not going to be comparable. They're not going to sell a lot, but at the right time we think it's going to switch over. And so I think we're going to have sitting alongside each other is the current products and how we're evolving that, and some simplified ones that are there, and some customers and some advisors may go to it. Great, but eventually we think it's going to tip to more and more come into both.
I think the key point around this is understanding. Mm. So however the products are designed, that they are able to be understood by customers.
Yes.
And that's the key point, which I know we're spending a lot of time thinking about. And we offer products through retail, and we offer products outside of retail, which are simpler in design. And so you can point to that and say that's a simpler product and that's a more complex product. The key question we're trying to answer is, regardless, does the customer understand what they've got? And I think if we can focus on that as an industry, and that's life insurers, distributors, distribution partners, advisors, superannuation funds, then there is some real gain to be had in increasing understanding of what these products do and how you can claim them, those sorts of things.
Okay, so let's move on a little. Earlier this afternoon, there was some discussion about ways that the industry might better collaborate. So, for example, in terms of sharing data, or maybe standardised definitions, like literally using standardised definitions. What are your thoughts on that? And before you answer, there was also, I think it was Adrian Rees from APRA, who put a question to the audience saying, how important do you think collection of data is? You know, and a forest of hands go up.
Yes.
And then he asked why...
Well, I hope this group of people would say data is important.
Why are you so poor at collecting data? So it was a very valid question.
Look, I'm happy to go first. In terms of... So I think collection of data, I think we're seeing the industry coming together to share more data. There's working groups that are currently in play to develop guidelines around what that data is and how we make sure we don't breach any sort of privacy and IP, but at the same time get the data together so that we can collectively as an industry make better decisions and get better quality outcomes for customers. That's definitely in train. Mm. So I think we agree, and we've gone a long way. I mean, the life insurance industry and life insurers within that have come a long way over the last few years by necessity. Okay, so, you know, when you have an issue like what we saw in superannuation, or you talk about these income protection issues, or you talk about Royal Commissions and customers' expectations and claim services, all of those things have meant that we've had to come together and actually start talking to each other in a very collaborative way without crossing the boundaries about what we can do better collectively, because it's not healthy for anyone to not have a sustainable industry. So we are seeing that data collection and move to sharing data more coming through in the market, and we support that. We just got to make sure that, you know, we do the right thing from a compliance perspective and privacy of information, etc., and recognise that everyone's okay with that data being shared.
And standard definitions, where, you know, should the industry be competing on definitions, or should there be a standardised approach to definitions and the industry then competes on other features?
I'm generally not a fan of standardised definitions. If you think about something like, say, trauma products, which is classically where it comes up, and that has been the heart of some of the issues we've had to deal with over the last couple of years, and the classic heart attack. There are different severities of heart attack, and some customers may actually say, well, actually, I only want to be insured for a severe heart attack, and in that circumstance, I might need a larger amount of money for my lifestyle, for whatever reasons. And then other customers may have a view that, well, actually, I don't need that. I want something which pays out a claim on a much less severe heart attack, and I'm prepared to pay more for that. And I think we need to allow that, that choice and competition to emerge in the market. That's the customer angle, and then the industry angle is, you know, classically standard definition. So what do you compete on? Well, you're competing on other things, which maybe underwriting, claims, price, those sorts of things. So I'm generally not a fan of standardised definition approaches, and I haven't seen too many case studies globally where there's been good evidence that that's produced good outcomes for customer and industry.
Damien?
I agree. I'm not a fan of standard definitions. I like minimum standard definitions. I think that, you know, we want to make sure that everyone sort of has a minimum standard that we all aspire to, and customers can expect that that's covered. But then I think that it should be a minimum, not a standard definition, because it stops innovation, it stops progress. I think it makes us lazy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that's where we ended up with Life Code. There's a safety net definition in that.
Yep.
And that was the whole idea. That was,
sure,
as Damien's described. Yeah.
Okay. So very quickly on remuneration, commissions and so on, do you think the current arrangements are sustainable? And do you think that they might be a bit of a ball and chain when it comes to social licence?
Ball and chain for who?
For the industry, you know, in the sense that it won't necessarily ever get the right outcome for customers.
I think over a longer period of time, I don't know what that will be, say 5 or 10 years, I'd be surprised if we're in an environment where the current LIFT framework still remains.
Yes.
That would surprise me, given all the energy is heading in a different direction.
Yep.
You know, the current debate around grandfather commissions, there's going to be another ASIC review in 2021, I think, into retail advice. And, you know, the link that ASIC drew was the correlation between high upfront commissions and poor advice. Mm-hmm. And that's the lens they're looking through it, and that's the lens they'll look through it again in 2021 as well. It's pretty unlikely that they won't find poor advice when they look at it at 2021, that just with the amount of advice that's given. So it's hard to see in the longer term where we would remain in a LIFT environment.
Damien, do you agree with that?
Yeah, so for me, I think it's actually one of the areas where, you know, we need to be careful that we don't react just to one part of the system. So let's go back and think about sustainability, your question, Anne, okay? So when I look out and think about it, one of the questions I hear is, and I absolutely support, and so does Brett, is that financial advisors play a critical role in helping Australians get the right amount, right protection for them and their families, and also financial plans in place, which is really important. So what I'd be looking at, and given that Australia is accumulating through superannuation and other things, wealth, we know that there's going to actually be more of a need for financial advice for Australians. So how do we actually think about sustainability? So actually, if we're going to have 25 million people in Australia, working people in Australia by 2030, what number of financial advisors do we need in the system that can provide a quality service to Australians to help them with their needs? Then how do we build policy to help people, advisors, get there and have a flourishing advice industry that supports that? You know, all of our policies all reactive at the moment, and your point, Ian, is absolutely right. So the word commission probably has a natural, easy target, but actually you talk to customers and with the appropriate disclosure, there, many of them are happy to have that commission paid, as opposed to paying a fee up front, because that would stop them from actually getting the advice. So I think it's about disclosure, and it's about actually about back to the sustainability. How do we make sure financial advisors have a sustainable business practice so they can do a really important service for Australians? And if commissions are part of that, then I support that we continue to do so, but we need to have the appropriate disclosures and make sure the appropriate measures are there.
There inevitably will be tensions there, though, no matter how well that's
done. There are absolutely tensions in there, and I think we need to allow industry to evolve.
Exactly.
And that's perhaps a bit of the challenge we've got at the moment, is that there is a lot of very heated debate around these sorts of issues, and a quick flip from one system to another system could create all sorts of consequences, and we need to allow industry to evolve.
And some of the issues we've heard recently in the press and haven't been commission related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, sure.
But, no, I'm not saying you are, but I'm just saying I think we just need to be careful that it is one area that needs to be monitored within the overall system, but some of these practices we're hearing about haven't been commission related at all.
No, I accept that, yeah. Mm. So life insurance codes, we touched on this before, so life insurance code, the life and super code, are they a good thing for customers?
Yeah, I think they are. I think life insurance was strangely absent for many, many years around codes of practice where they were well established in banking and other areas for a long period of time, and general insurance as well, very well established and well regarded by and large, I think. So life insurance looked really odd that it did not have a code. I think it's a very positive step for industry. And the code that we have today will not be the code that we've got in even 2 or 3 years' time. Mm-hmm. It will evolve rapidly, and even now the FSC is working on version 2 and looking to push it further now that the first version is largely in place for most insurers. And I think we need to judge it its effectiveness over a period of time rather than draw too many conclusions straight away.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a supporter of the code, and I think, you know, it is important that we have that but it's a hygiene factor too. That doesn't mean that we should just aspire to the code. I think what we're seeing through the Royal Commission is that compliance with your obligations is one lens, but customer expectations and service and other things are really, that doesn't get covered by complying with the code. You know, you've got to think about the customer through those individual circumstances as well. So I think the code is a very important hygiene factor, but it's just there to, you know, ensure that the industry is meeting a minimum obligation, but we need to look further than that.
Should ASIC have some enforcement powers, because that's been mooted?
Over the code,
yeah.
Yeah, so there's a regime for financial services codes to be registered with ASIC. Mm. I think it's inevitable that the life code will be, and I think it should be. There's a regime there. There's a whole process, and I just think it makes common sense for that to happen. Mm.
Yeah, I agree. If some sort of oversight is really important for the code to have.
It gives it credibility.
Yeah. But Ian, I think there's just one comment. I know. Sorry, not because I did hear a bill. This group, it's not often we get a chance to sit with this group. And I know we had a wall out there about the budget changes, and do you agree and don't you? The only thing I would say to this group is we have a really interesting challenge as a group. When we talk about this wonderful industry that we're in and making sure that we continue to do great things to help Australians, regardless of where the specifics land, if there is change where we have things like people being able to opt in and significant changes to that system, this group here will really need to contemplate how we assess by looking at models, you know, financial economic models of the past to inform the future, because actually it's going to be a very difficult challenge that we have. And we've got to make sure we don't repeat the issues of what we've experienced in 12, 13 and, you know, and other things when small tweaks to such a large industry had dramatic impact. Okay? So when we collectively have to face into these challenges wherever they land, working collectively with superannuation funds and within our teams, we're going to really need to be able to understand how we're going to be able to get that right so we don't have unintended consequences for the sustainability over the long term for Australians.
We're nearly out of time, but very quickly, just a quick comment on mental health. We touched on it earlier. What, if anything, do you think the industry could have done better in terms of dealing with mental health? And, of course, there are future issues which we probably don't have time to go into, but just a quick observation on how we might have better dealt with mental health issues.
Oh, look, I think it's hindsight. You know, it's wonderful to be able to think about it and go back. But actually, I think what we probably didn't understand was just how quickly the issue was going to grow. But also, I think, the impacts of the lifestyles that we're living were going to impact that as well. I think, you know, when you look at it, 45% of Australians will incur some sort of mental health issue throughout their life. That means one in every two, right? So basically, it's an issue that we need to continue to shine a light on. I think we need to look at it in the big things we need to do and the small things we need to do. So big things, we need to advocate for the legislative changes that we're all behind around the ability for life insurers to help people with early intervention and treatment of medical vehicle payments. And then there's the smaller things we need to do, which is around continuing to make it okay for people to talk about these issues. We need to do the small things as an employer, as colleagues, around helping each other and the people we work with. And so there's a range of things we need to do. But I think as an industry, what we need to look at is what are the impacts that are causing these increasing mental health issues, and what are the trends in those areas? Because if stress-related and overwork and all those other things are causing that, are those trends going away or are they getting worse? And so then how do we get preventative action? Because we don't want to actually be dealing with it afterwards. We want to be able, and we want to support and assist people, but how do we get ahead of it and identify the issues that are causing it and make interventions there?
Sorry. And Brett, your thoughts on that from an actuarial profession point of view?
Oh, I got kicked out almost. I would just say back to social licence, Ian. If we're really serious about social licence and mental health is such a serious societal issue, then we have to provide products which respond to mental health conditions. I think that's point one. I think that's unavoidable if we're serious about social licence and our role in the community. The second thing I'd say would be that we're experts in insurance, we're not experts in mental health. And as an industry, we just need to learn more. And that generally sits outside of lots of data, and it's understanding personal conditions around mental health and how our products, underwriting processes, claims processes need to respond and support people with mental health. So as an industry, we've just got to do more to learn. And you know, that's certainly something I think we have done and will continue to do.
Okay, so we've run out of time, but one last question. The Royal Commission is undoubtedly going to make some observations on remuneration in the banking sector. Mm-hmm. As you know, the BEAR, Bank Executive Accountability Regime, comes into play 1 July. There's been talk, political and otherwise, of the BEAR regime being extended to the life industry. And I guess one of the benefits of that potentially might be that there's better alignment between the remuneration arrangements and how long it takes poor risk management in underwriting, claims management and so on to manifest itself within a life company. So better alignment with the product cycle. So just very quickly, would it be a good thing for the BEAR regime to be applied to the life industry or not?
You'd be a brave person to suggest it won't, I think. Getting REM structures right in life insurance is actually really, really hard because of the way these businesses operate. The impacts of decisions you make today only play out and you only see them and evidence them over a very, very long period of time. So I know you've talked about this before in a past life, how you build REM structures around this is actually very, very difficult, I think, because ultimately you've got to compete for talent in the market as well. And I think there is a natural tension there, which I'm not sure what the right answer is. It may be BEAR or something that looks like BEAR. If you need REM structures today to help you guide good decision-making and risk management in your organisation or life insurance company, then you've got a big problem.
Okay. We are out of time, but Damien, a quick comment on that.
No, I think, you know, it's right now with the Royal Commission, everything's on the table. Mm-hmm. And as I said, remuneration is one of the components of the many that will be under. I'm sure there'll be some change around it. But I'm with Brett. You know, if it's in an environment with low maturity, you use the lowest common denominator to get behavioural change. What we need to focus about is how do we embed a culture around doing the right thing. And that's not always just, while you're low maturity, you use REM, but hopefully there's, you know, other ways in which we can get people to do the right thing, and I'm sure they will.
Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time, but not just your time, your openness and the insights that you've given to us. And I have to say, from a personal point of view, it's great to see how broadly you're thinking. So please thank them all.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks, Ian.